hit the wall. There was nowhere left to go. I took a blow to the stomach, and then the tongue that had hit me uncurled and moved to wrap around my neck. I needed to run, but I was stunned, doubled over, breath knocked out of me. Then I heard an angry snarl, one that hadn't come from the hollow, and a stout, echoing bark. Addison! Suddenly the tongue that was reaching for my neck stiffened as if in pain and retracted across the room. The dog, that brave little boxer, had bitten it. I heard him growling and yelping as he began to do battle with an invisible creature 20 times his size. I slid to the floor, back against the wall, breath filling my lungs again. I held up the vial, determined now, convinced I had no chance without it. I pulled the cork, raised the bottle above my eyes, and tilted back my head. And then I heard my name.
"Jacob,"
softly spoken in the dark, a few feet away. I turned to look, and there on the floor, lying amidst a pile of parts, was Miss Peregrine. Bruised, tied, struggling to speak through a haze of pain or drugs, but there nonetheless, and gazing at me with those piercing green eyes.
"Don't,"
she said softly.
"Don't do that."
Her voice barely audible, barely there. "Miss Peregrine!" I lowered the vial, corked it, scrambled on my hands to where she lay. This second mother of mine, this peculiar saint, fallen, hurt, dying, perhaps.
"Tell me you're okay," I said.
"Put that down," she said.
"You don't need it."
"Yes, I do. I'm not like he was." We both knew who I meant. My grandfather.
"Yes, you are,"
she said.
"Everything you need is inside you already. Put it down and take that instead."
She nodded at something lying between us, a jagged stake of wood from a broken chair. "I can't. It's not enough."
"It is,"
she assured me.
"Just aim for the eyes."
"I can't," I said, but I did. I put down the vial and took the stake.
"Good lad,"
she whispered.
"Now, go and do something gruesome with it."
"I will," I said, and she smiled, her head sinking back to the floor. I stood up, determined now, the wooden stake gripped in my hand. Across the room, Addison had his teeth clamped deep into one of the hollow's tongues and was riding it like a rodeo cowboy, clinging valiantly and snarling as the hollow whipped him back and forth. Emma had cut down Miss Wren from the rope where she'd been hanging and was standing guard over her, swinging her flaming hands blindly. The hollow smacked Addison into a pole, and the dog was flung loose. I started toward the hollow, running as fast as I could through an obstacle course of scattered limbs. But like a moth to flame, the creature seemed more interested in Emma. It was starting to close in on her, and so I shouted at it, first in English, "Hey, over here!" And then in hollow, "Come and get me, you bastard!" I picked up the closest thing at hand, which happened to be a hand, and threw it. It bounced off the hollow's back, and the thing turned around to face me.
"Come and get me! Come and get me!"
For a moment, the hollow was confused, which was just enough time for me to get close to it without getting caught up in its tongues. I stabbed it with the stake once, twice in the chest. It reacted as if it had been stung by a bee, no worse than that, and then knocked me to the ground with a tongue.
"Stop! Stop! Stop!"
I shouted in hollow, desperate for something to get through, but the beast seemed bulletproof, totally inoculated against my suggestions. And then I remembered the finger, the little chalk stub of dust in my pocket. As I reached for it, a tongue wrapped around me and hoisted me into the air. I could hear Emma shouting at it to put me down, and call, too.
"Don't you eat him!" he screeched over the PA. "He's mine!"
As I drew Mother Dust's finger from my pocket, the hollow dropped me into its open jaws. I was trapped in its mouth from knees to chest, its teeth pinning me in place, starting to cut into my flesh, its jaws quickly expanding to swallow me. This would be my last act, my last moment. I crushed the finger in my hand and shoved it down what I hoped was the hollow's throat. Emma was beating it, burning it, and then, just before it could close its jaws and saw me in half with its teeth, the creature began to choke. It stumbled away from Emma, burned and gagging, retreating toward the grate in the floor from which it had crawled, bounding back to its nest, where it would have all the time it wanted to devour me. I tried to stop it, to shout, "Let me go!" But it was biting down, and the pain was so blacking that I couldn't think. And then we were there, at the grate, slipping down into it, its mouth so full of me that it couldn't catch hold of the rungs on the wall, and it was falling, falling and choking, and I was still, somehow, alive. When we hit bottom, it was with a great bone-breaking crack that flattened our lungs and sent all the sedative dust I'd shoved down the hollow's gullet blowing into the air around us. As it snowed down, I could feel it working, numbing my pain and dulling my brain, and it must have been doing the same to the hollow, because it was hardly biting me at all now, its jaws slackening. As we lay in a stunned and tranquilized pile, racing towards sleep, I could see forming before me, through all those billowing white particles, a dank and lightless tunnel, heaped with bones. The last thing I saw before the dust took me was a throng of hollows, hunched and curious, shuffling forward.
Chapter 8.
I woke up. That in itself is worthy of note, I think, given the circumstances. I was in the hollow's burrow, and piled around me were the bodies of many hollowgast. They might have been dead, but it was likelier they'd breathed what remained of Mother Dust's pinky finger, and the result was tangled in a spaghetti of stinking, snoring, mostly unconscious hollow flesh. I gave a silent prayer of thanks for Mother Dust, and then wondered, with rising alarm, how long I'd been down here. An hour? A day? What had happened to everyone above? I had to go. A few of the hollows were beginning to stir from sleep, like me, but they were still woozy. With great effort, I stood. Apparently my wounds were not so grave, my bones not so broken. I swayed, dizzy, then caught my balance and began to move through the enmeshed hollows. I kicked one in the head by accident. With a grunt it came awake and opened its eyes. I froze, thinking that if I ran, it would only chase me down. It seemed to register me, but as neither a threat nor a potential meal, then closed its eyes again. I continued on, placing each foot with care until I had passed the carpet of hollows and reached a wall. Here the tunnel ended. The way out was above me, a chute leading upward 100 feet or so to an open grate in that cluttered room. There were holds along the chute, but they were spaced too far apart, built for hollows' acrobatic tongues, not human hands and feet. I stood peering up at a ring of dim light far overhead, hoping a friendly face might appear there, but I dared not shout for help. In desperation, I jumped, scrabbling at the hard wall and grasping for the first hold. Somehow I reached it, pulled myself up. Suddenly, I was more than 10 feet off the ground. How had I done that? I jumped again and reached the next hold, and the next one. I was climbing the chute, my legs launching me higher and my arms reaching farther than I knew was possible. This is insane. And then I was at the top, poking my head out, pushing myself up into the room. I wasn't even breathing hard. I looked around, saw Emma's firelight, and ran toward it across the cluttered floor. I tried calling out, but couldn't seem to make the words. No matter. There she was, on the other side of the open glass door, in the office. Warren was on this side, tied to the chair Miss Glassbill had sat in, and when I came close, he groaned fearfully and knocked himself over. Then their faces were at the door, suspicious and peering, Emma and Miss Peregrine and Horace, and behind them other Imbrins and friends too. All there, alive, beautiful. They had been freed from their cells, only to be imprisoned once more in here, locked behind Call's bomb-proof bunker door, safe from whites, for now, but trapped. Their expressions were fearful, and the closer I got to the glass door, the more terrified they became. "It's me," I tried to say, but the words didn't come out right, and my friends jumped back. "It's me! It's Jacob!" What came out instead of English was a husky snarl and 3 long, fat tongues waving in the air before me, spat from my own mouth in my attempt to speak. And then I heard one of my friends, Enoch, say aloud the terrible thing that had just occurred to me.
"It's a hollow!" "I'm not," I tried to say. "I'm not."
But all evidence was to the contrary. I had somehow become one of them, been bitten and turned like a vampire, or been killed, eaten, recycled, reincarnated. "Oh God, oh God, oh God, it can't be." I tried to reach out with my hands, to make some sign that might be recognized as human now that my mouth had failed me, but it was my tongues that reached out.
"I'm sorry, I'm sorry. I don't know how to drive this thing."
Emma swiped blindly at me with her hand and connected. Sudden searing pain flashed through me, and then I woke up. Again. Or rather, jolted by sudden pain, I woke back into my body, my hurt human body, still lying in the dark in the slack jaws of a sleeping hollow. And yet, I was still the hollow above, too, snatching my hurt tongue back into my mouth and stumbling away from the door. I was somehow dually present in both my mind and the hollows, and I found now that I could control both, could lift my own arm and the hollows, turn my own head and the hollows, and do it all without saying a word aloud, but merely by thinking. Without realizing it, without consciously trying, I had mastered the hollow to such a degree, seeing through its eyes, feeling through its skin, that it had felt, for a time, like I was the hollow. But now a distinction was becoming clear. I was this fallible and broken-bodied boy, deep in a hole surrounded by groggy monsters. They were waking, all but the one who had brought me down here in its jaws. It had so much dust in its system that it might sleep for years, and they were sitting up now, shaking the numbness from their limbs. But they didn't seem interested in killing me. They were watching me, quiet and attentive, semi-circled around like well-behaved children at story time, waiting for input. I rolled myself out of the hollow's jaws and onto the floor. I could sit up, but was too hurt to stand. But they could stand.
Stand.
I didn't say it. Didn't even think it, really. It felt like doing, only it wasn't me who did it. They did it. 11 hollowghast all rising to their feet before me in perfect synchrony. This was astounding, of course, and yet I felt a profound sense of calm spreading through me. I was relaxing into the purest depths of my ability. Something about shutting down all our minds at once, then bringing them back online together, a collective reboot, had brought us into a kind of harmony, allowing me to tap into the unconscious heart of my power, as well as into the hollow's minds at just the moment their defenses were down. And now they were mine. Marionettes I could control with invisible strings. But how much could I do? What were the limits? How many could I control at once, discreetly? To find out, I began to play. In the room above, I lay the hollow down. He lay down. They were all he's, I had decided. I made the ones in front of me jump. They jumped. They were two distinct groups now, the loner above and the ones before me. I tried controlling each individually, making one raise a hand without the rest doing it. It was a bit like asking just one toe on your foot to wiggle. Difficult, not impossible, but before long, I'd gotten the hang of it. The less conscious I was of trying, the easier it became. The control came most naturally when I simply imagined an action being performed. I sent them away into the bone piles farther down the tunnel, then had them pick up bones with their tongues and toss them to one another. First, one at a time, then two, then three and four, piling action upon action until I'd gotten up to six. It was only when I made the hollow upstairs stand and do jumping jacks that the bone tossers began to miss catches. I don't think it would be bragging to say I was very good at this, a natural even. I could tell that with more time to practice, I had the capacity to become masterful. I could have played both sides of an all-hollow basketball game. I could have made them dance every roll in Swan Lake. But there was no more time to practice. This would have to do. And so I gathered them around me, had the strongest one pick me up and saddle me to its back with a wrapped-around tongue, and one by one, my monstrous little army bounded up the chute and into the room above. The overhead lights had been turned on in the cluttered room, and in their harsh glow I could see that the only bodies remaining were mannequins and models. The Imbrans had all been taken out. The glass door to Call's observation room was closed. I made the hollows hang back while I approached it alone, save the hollow I was riding, then called out to my friends, this time with my own voice, in English.
"It's me! It's Jacob!"
They rushed to the door, Emma's face circled by the others.
"Jacob!"
Her voice was muffled behind the glass.
"You're alive!"
But as she studied me, her face turned strange, as if she couldn't understand what she was seeing. Because I was on the hollow's back, I realized, it looked to Emma like I was floating above the ground.
"It's all right," I said. "I'm riding a hologast!"
I slapped its shoulder to prove there was something solid and fleshy beneath me.
"He's completely under my control, and so are these."
I brought the 11 hollows forward, stamping their feet to announce themselves. My friends' mouths went oval-shaped with wonder.
"Is that really you, Jacob?"
Olive asked.
"What do you mean you're controlling them?"
Enix said.
"You've got blood on your shirt," said Bronwyn.
They opened the glass door just wide enough to talk through. I explained how I fell into the hollow's pit, was nearly bitten in half, was numbed and put to sleep, and woke up with a dozen of them under my control. As further demonstration, I had the hollows pick up Warren, the chair he was tied to and all, and toss him back and forth a few times, the chair flipping end over end until the kids were cheering and Warren was groaning as if he was going to be sick. Finally, I had them set him down.
"If I hadn't seen it with my own eyes, I'd never have believed it," Enix said.
"Not in a million years."
"You're fantastic,"
I heard a little voice say, and there was Claire.
"Let me get a look at you,"
I said, but when I approached the open door, she shrank away. Impressed with my skills, though they were, overcoming a peculiar's natural fear of hologast is no easy thing, and the smell probably didn't help either.
"It's safe," I said. "I promise."
Olive came right to the door.
"I'm not scared."
"Me neither," said Emma. "And me first."
She stepped through the door and came to meet me. I made the hollow kneel, leaned away from it, and managed somewhat awkwardly to put my arms around Emma.
"Sorry, I can't quite stand up on my own," I said, my face against her cheek, my closed eyes brushing her soft hair.
It wasn't enough, but for now it would have to be.
"You're hurt."
She pulled away to look me over.
"You've got cuts everywhere, and they're deep."
"I can't feel them. I got dust all over me."
"That could mean you're only numb, not healed."
"I'll worry about it later. How long was I down there?"
"Hours," she whispered. "We thought you were dead."
I nudged her forehead with mine. "I made you a promise, remember?"
"I need you to make me a new promise. Quit scaring the hell out of me."
"I'll do my best."
"No. Promise."
"Once this is over, I'll make any promise you like."
"I'm going to remember that," she said.
Miss Peregrine appeared at the door.
"You two had better come in here. And leave that beast outside, please."
"Miss P," I said, "you're on your feet."
"Yes, I'm recovering," she replied. "I was spared by my late arrival here, and by some nepotistic favoritism on my brother's part. Not all my fellow Imbrins were so lucky."
"I wasn't sparing you, sister,"
said a booming voice from above. "Call again, through the PA system."
"I was merely saving the tastiest dish for last."
"You shut up!"
Emma shouted.
"When we find you, Jacob's Hollows will eat you for breakfast!" Call laughed.
I doubt that, he said.
You're more powerful than I imagined, boy. But don't be fooled. You're surrounded with no way out. You've only delayed the inevitable. But if you give up now, I might consider sparing some of you.
With a quick flick of their tongues, I made the hollows rip the speakers from the ceiling and smash them on the ground. As wires and parts sprang everywhere, Call's voice went dead.
When we find him, Enix said, I'd like to pull out his fingernails before we kill him. Anyone have a problem with that?
As long as I can send a squadron of bees up his nose first, said Hugh.
That's not our way, Miss Peregrine said. When this is all over, he'll be sentenced by Imbrinic law to rot in a punishment loop for the rest of his unnatural life.
Where's the fun in that? Said Enoch.
Miss Peregrine gave him a withering look. I made the hollow let me go, and with Emma's help, I limped through the door and into the observation room. My friends were all there, all but Fiona. Ranged along the walls and resting on office chairs, I could see pale, frightened faces watching me. The Imbrins. But before I could go to them, my friends blocked my way. They threw their arms around me, holding up my tottering body with their embraces. I gave in to it. I hadn't felt anything so sweet in a long time. Then Addison came trotting up as nobly as he could with two hurt paws, and I broke away to greet him. "That's twice now you've saved me," I said, putting a hand on his furry head. "I don't know how I'll ever repay you."
"You can start by getting us out of this bloody loop," he growled. "I'm sorry I ever crossed that bridge."
Those who heard him laughed. Maybe it was his canine nature, but Addison had no filter. He always said just what he meant. "That stunt you pulled with the truck was one of the bravest things I ever saw," I said.
"I was captured the minute I got inside the compound. I'm afraid I let you all down."
There was a sudden, loud boom from outside the heavy door. The room shook. Small items tumbled off shelves.
"The whites are trying to blow in the door," Miss Peregrine explained. "They've been at it for some time."
"We'll deal with them," I said. "But first I want to know who's unaccounted for. Things will get out of hand when we open that door. So if there are peculiars elsewhere in this compound who need rescuing, I want to keep them in mind as we go into battle." It was so dark and crowded that we resorted to a roll call. I called our friends' names twice, just to make doubly sure they were all here. Then I asked after the peculiars who'd been snatched from Miss Wren's ice house alongside us. The clown, thrown into the chasm, Olive told us through hitching sobs, for refusing orders from the whites. The folding man, left on the underground in grave condition. Telekinetic Melina, upstairs and unconscious, having had some of her soul drained. And the pale brothers, same. Then there were the kids Miss Wren had rescued. The plain-looking boy in the floppy hat and the frizzy-haired snake-charmer girl. Bronwyn said she'd seen them being led off to another part of the compound, where other peculiars were being held. Lastly, we counted the Imbrins. There was Miss Peregrine, of course, whose side the kids had not left since they were reunited. There was so much I wanted to talk with her about. All that had happened to us since we last saw her. All that had happened to her. Though there was no time to say any of it, something did pass between us, in the brief moments our eyes would meet in passing. She regarded Emma and me with a certain pride and wonder. "I trust you,"
her eyes said. But Miss Peregrine, as deeply glad as we were to see her, wasn't the only Imbrin we had to be concerned about. There were 12 in all. She introduced her friends. Miss Wren, whom Emma had cut down from the ceiling, was wounded but coherent. Miss Glassbill was still staring in her vague and mindless way. The eldest, Miss Avocet, who hadn't been seen since she and Miss Peregrine were kidnapped together on Cairnholm, occupied a chair near the door. Miss Bunting, Miss Tree Creeper, and several others fussed over her, adjusting blankets around her shoulders. Nearly all of them looked frightened, which seemed distinctly un-Imbrin-like. They were supposed to be our elders and our leaders, but they'd been in captivity here for weeks, and they had seen things and had things done to them that had left them shell-shocked. They also didn't share my friend's confidence in my ability to control a dozen hologast, and were keeping as far away from my creatures as the dimensions of the room would allow. At the end of it, there was still one person among us who hadn't been named, a bearded, small-statured man who stood silently by the Imbrins, watching us through dark glasses. "And who's this?" I said. "A white?" The man became incensed. "No!" He tore off the glasses to show us his eyes, which were severely crossed. "I am Heme," he said, his accent thick in Italian. There was a large leather-bound book on a table next to him, and he pointed to it, as if this somehow explained his identity. I felt a hand on my arm. It was Millard, invisible now, his suit of stripes removed. "Allow me to introduce history's foremost temporal cartographer," he said grandly. "Jacob, this is Perplexus Anomalous."
"Buongiorno," said Perplexus. "How do you do?"
"It's an honor to meet you," I said.
"Yes," he said, nose rising in the air. "It is."
"What's he doing here?" I whispered to Millard. "And how is he still alive?"
"Cole found him living in some 14th-century loop in Venice that no one knew existed. He's been here 2 days, though, which means he could age forward very soon."
As I had come to understand such things, Perplexus was in danger of aging forward because the loop he'd been living in was considerably older than the one we were in now, and the difference between those times would eventually catch up with him.
"I'm your biggest fan," Millard said to Perplexus. "I have all your maps."
"Yes, you tell me already," Perplexus said. "Grazie."
"None of that explains what he's doing here," said Emma.
"Perplexus wrote about finding the Library of Souls in his journals," said Millard. "So Cole tracked him down, kidnapped him, and made him tell where it was."
"I made oath of blood to never say nothing," Perplexus said miserably. "Now I am cursed forever."
"I want to get Perplexus back to his loop before he ages," said Millard. "I won't be responsible for the loss of Peculiardom's greatest living treasure."
From outside the door came another boom, this one even bigger and louder than before. The room trembled and pebbly bits of rock rained from the ceiling.
"We'll do our best, dear," Miss Peregrine said. "But we've got other things to see about first."
We quickly hatched a plan of action, such as it was. Throw open the big door and use my hollows to clear the way. They were expendable, seemed in good working order, and my connection with them was only growing stronger. As for what could go wrong, I dared not even wonder. We would find Call if we could, but our priority was escaping the compound alive. I brought my hollows into the little room. Everyone gave them a wide berth, pressing their backs to the walls and their hands over their noses as the creatures shuffled past and gathered round the heavy door. The largest hollow knelt down, and I saddled myself to him once more, which made me so tall I had to hunch forward to keep my head from scraping the ceiling. We could hear the voices of whites outside in the corridor. No doubt they were planting another bomb. We decided to wait until they set it off before going out, so we stood by, waiting, a taut silence filling the room. Finally, Bronwyn broke the tension.
"I think Mr. Jacob should say something to all of us."
"Like what?" I said, making my hollow turn so I was facing everyone.
"Well, you're about to lead us into battle," said Bronwyn. "Something leaderly?"
"Something inspiring," said Hugh.
"Something that'll make us less terrified," said Horace.
"That's a lot of pressure," I said, feeling a bit self-conscious. "I don't know if this will make anyone less terrified, but it's something I've been thinking about. I've only known you for a few weeks, but it feels like so much longer than that. You're the best friends I've ever had. And it's weird to think that just a couple of months ago, I was back at home, and I didn't even know you were real. And I still had my grandfather." There were noises outside in the hall, muffled voices, the thud of something metal being dropped on the ground. I continued louder.
"I miss my grandfather every day. But a very smart friend once told me that everything happens for a reason. If I hadn't lost him, well, I never would have found you. So I guess I had to lose one part of my family to find another. Anyway, that's how you make me feel. Like family. Like one of you."
"You are one of us," Emma said. "You're our family." "We love you, Jacob," said Olive.
"It's been quite something knowing you, Mr. Portman," Miss Peregrine said. "You would have made your grandfather very proud." "Thanks," I said, getting emotional and a bit embarrassed.
"Jacob," said Horace, "may I give you something?"
"Of course," I said. The others, sensing that something private was unfolding between us, began to murmur amongst themselves. Horace came as close to the hollow as he could bear, and, trembling slightly, held out a folded square of cloth. I took it, reaching down from my high place on the hollow's back.
"It's a scarf," said Horace. "Miss P was able to smuggle me a pair of needles, and I knitted it while I was in my cell. I reckon that making it kept me from going mad in there."
I thanked him and unfolded it. The scarf was simple and gray with knotted tassels on the ends, but it was well made and even had my initials monogrammed in one corner. J.P.
"Wow, Horace. It's no great work of art. If I'd had my book of patterns, I could have done better."
"It's amazing," I said. "But how did you know you'd even see me again?"
"I had a dream," he said, smiling coyly. "Will you wear it? I know it isn't cold, but... for luck."
"Of course," I said, and wrapped it clumsily around my neck.
"No, that'll never stay on, like this."
He showed me how to fold it in half lengthwise, then loop it around my neck and back through itself, so that it knotted perfectly at my throat, and the loose ends hung neatly down my shirt. Not exactly battle wear, but I didn't see the harm. Emma sidled up to us.
"Did you dream about anything besides men's fashion?" she said to Horace. like where Cole might be hiding?"
Horace shook his head and started to answer.
"No, but I did have a fascinating dream about postage stamps."
But before he could tell us more, there was a noise from the corridor like a dump truck crashing into a wall, a sonic thud that shook us to the marrow. The big bunker door in the end of the room blew open, flinging hinges and bits of shrapnel into the opposite walls. Thankfully, everyone had been standing clear of it. There followed a blank moment while the smoke cleared and everyone slowly uncrouched themselves. Then, through the ringing of my ears, I heard an amplified voice say,
"Send the boy out alone, and no one gets hurt!"
"Somehow I don't believe them," said Emma.
"Definitely not," said Horace.
"Don't even think about it, Mr. Portman," said Miss Peregrine.
"I wasn't," I replied. "Is everyone ready?" Murmurs of assent. I moved the hollows to either side of the door, their great jaws hinging open, tongues at the ready. I was about to launch my surprise attack when I heard Call's voice through a PA in the hallway.
"They have control of the hollows! Fall back, men! Defensive positions!"
"Damn him!"
Emma cried. The sound of retreating boots filled the corridor. Our surprise attack had been spoiled.
"It doesn't matter," I said. "When you've got 12 hollows, you don't need surprise."
It was time to use my secret weapon. Rather than a welling up of tension before the strike, I felt the opposite, a loosening of my full and present self as my awareness relaxed and split among the hollows. And then, while my friends and I hung back, the creatures began hurling themselves through the jagged, blasted door into the hall, running, snarling, jaws gaping, their invisible bodies carving tunnels in the curling bomb smoke. The whites fired at them, their gun barrels flashing, then fell back. Bullets whizzed through the open doorway and into the room where I and the others were taking cover, cracking into the wall behind us.
"Tell us when!" Emma shouted. "We'll go at your word!"
My mind in a dozen places at once, I could muster hardly a word of English in reply. I was them, those hollows in the hall, my own flesh stinging in sympathy with every shot that tore theirs. Our tongues reached them first. The whites who had not run fast enough, and the brave but foolish ones who'd lingered to fight. We pummeled them, smacked their heads into the walls, and a small number of us stopped to— here I tried to disconnect my own senses— to sink our teeth into them, swallowing their guns, silencing their screams, leaving them gashed and gaping. Bottlenecked at the stairs at the end of the corridor, the guards fired again. A second curtain of bullets passed through us, deep and painful, but we ran on, tongues flailing. Some of the whites escaped through the hatch. Others weren't so lucky. And when they'd stopped screaming, we tossed their bodies clear of the stairs. I felt two of my hollows die, their signals blanking from my mind, the connection lost. And then the corridor was clear.
"Now!"
I said to Emma, which at the moment was the most complex speech I could manage.
"Now!"
Emma shouted, turning to the rest of our group.
"This way!"
I drove my hollow into the corridor, clutching at its neck to keep from being thrown off its back. Emma fell in behind me with the others, using her flaming hands as signals in the smoke. Together we charged down the hall, my battalion of monsters before me, my army of peculiars behind. First among them were the strongest and the bravest, Emma, Bronwyn, and Hugh, then the Imbrins and grumbling Perplexus,
who insisted on bringing his heavy map of days. Last came the youngest children, the timid, and the injured. The corridor smelled of gunpowder and blood.
"Don't look!"
I heard Bronwyn say as we began to pass the bodies of dead whites. I counted them as we ran. There were 5, 6, 7 of them to my 2 fallen hollows. Those were encouraging numbers, but how many whites were there in total? 40? 50? I worried that there were too many of them to kill and too many of us to protect, and that above ground we'd be easily overwhelmed, surrounded, and confused. I had to kill as many whites as I could before they broke into the open, and this fight turned into something we couldn't win. My awareness slid to the hollows again. Bounding up the spiral steps, the first one was up through the hatch, then searing pain, blankness. It had been ambushed as it came out. I made the next one out of the hatch pick up the dead one's body to use as a shield. It soaked up a volley of gunfire, pushing forward into the room as other hollows leapt from the hatch behind it. I had to push the whites out fast to get them away from the peculiars who lay everywhere in hospital beds. With a few lashes of our tongues, the closest ones were struck down, and the rest ran. I sent my hollows after them as we peculiars emerged from the hatch. There were so many of us now, so many hands, that unhooking our bed-ridden brethren from their soul drains would be easy. We spread out and made quick work of it. As for the chained madman and the boy we'd stashed in a closet, they were safer here than with us. We'd be back. Meanwhile, my remaining hollows chased the whites toward the building's exit. The whites fired wildly behind them as they fled. Snatching at their heels with our tongues, we were able to trip 2 or 3, who met a quick but gruesome end once my hollows caught up with them. One white had hidden himself behind a counter, where he was arming a bomb. A hollow rooted him out, then bundled both the white and his bomb into a side room. The bomb went off moments later. Another hollow winked out of my consciousness. The whites had scattered and more than half had escaped, diving through windows and outside doors. We were losing them. The fight was shifting. We'd finished unhooking the bed-ridden peculiars and had nearly caught up to my hollows, which now numbered 7, plus the one I was riding. We were near the exit, in the room of horrible tools, and we had a choice. I posed the question to those closest to me, Emma, Miss Peregrine, Enoch, Bronwyn. "Do we use the hollows as cover and run for the tower?" I said, my language coming back as the hollows I had to keep track of dwindled. "Or do we keep fighting?" Surprisingly, they all agreed.
"We can't stop now,"
Enoch said, wiping blood from his hands.
"If we do, they'll just keep chasing us forever," Bronwyn said.
"No, we won't,"
said an injured wight, who was cowering on the floor nearby.
"We'll sign a peace treaty."
"We tried that in 1945, said Miss Peregrine. "It wasn't worth the lavatory paper it was written on. We must keep fighting, children. We may not have such an opportunity again."
Emma raised a flaming hand.
"Let's burn this place to the ground."
I sent my hollows racing out of the lab building into the courtyard after the remaining whites. The hollows were ambushed again, and another was killed, going dark from my mind as it died. Save the one I was riding, by now all my hollows had taken at least a bullet apiece, but despite their wounds, most were still going strong. Hollows, as I had learned several times the hard way, are tough little buggers. The whites, on the other hand, seemed to be running scared. but that didn't mean I could count them out. Not knowing precisely where they were only made them more dangerous. I tried to keep my friends inside the building while I sent the Hollows to do reconnaissance, but the Peculiars were angry and charged up, itching to get into the fight.
"Out of my way!"
said Hugh, trying to push past Emma and me, who were blocking the door.
"It ain't fair for Jacob to do everything,"
Olive said.
"You've killed near half the Whites now, but I hate 'em just as much as you do. If anything, I've hated 'em longer, near 100 years. So come on!"
It was true. These kids had a century of White hatred to work out of their systems, and I was hogging all the glory. This was their fight, too, and it wasn't my place to keep them from it. "If you really want to help," I said to Olive, "here's what you can do." 30 seconds later, we were out in the open courtyard, and Horace and Hugh were reeling Olive up into the air by a rope around her waist. Right away, she became our invaluable eye in the sky, shouting back intel that my ground-bound Hollows could never have gathered.
"There's a couple to the right, past the little white shed, and another on the roof, and some running toward the big wall."
They hadn't scattered to the winds, but were mostly out beyond the courtyard. With any luck, they could still be caught. I called my 6 remaining Hollows back to us. Spread 4 of them into a phalanx that would march before us and 2 behind us as a guard against rear attacks. That left my friends and me to sweep the space between and deal with any Whites that might breach our wall of Hollows. We began marching toward the edge of the courtyard. Astride my personal Hollow, I felt like a general commanding his troops from horseback. Emma was at my side, and the other Peculiars were just behind, Bronwyn collecting loose bricks to hurl, Horace and Hugh hanging on to Olive's rope, Millard attaching himself to Perplexus, who was unleashing a constant stream of Italian profanities while shielding himself with his map of days. At the back, the Imbrins whistled and made loud bird calls in attempt to recruit winged friends to our cause, but Devil's Acre was such a dead zone that there were few wild birds to be found. Miss Peregrine had taken charge of old Miss Avocet and the few shell-shocked Imbrins. There was nowhere to leave them. They'd have to accompany us into battle. We came to the edge of the courtyard, beyond which was a run of open ground about 50 meters long. In all that space was just one small building, all that stood between us and the outer wall. It was a curious structure with a pagoda roof and tall, ornate doors, into which I saw a number of Whites flee. According to Olive, nearly all the remaining Whites had taken up positions inside the little building. One way or another, we were going to have to flush them out. A quiet had settled over the compound. There were no Whites visible anywhere. We lingered behind a protective wall to discuss our next move.
"What are they doing in there?" I said.
"Trying to lure us out into the open," Emma said.
"No problem. I'll send the Hollows."
"Won't that leave us unguarded?"
"I don't know that we have a choice. Olive counted 20 Whites going in there at least. I need to send enough Hollows to overwhelm them, or they'll just get slaughtered." I took a breath, scanned the tense, waiting faces around me. I sent the Hollows out one by one, sliding across the open yard on tiptoe, hoping light footsteps might allow them to surround the building unnoticed. It seemed to work. The building had 3 doors, and I managed to place 2 Hollows at each one without a single White showing his face. The Hollows stood guard outside the doors while I listened through their ears. Inside, I could hear someone with a high voice speaking, though I couldn't make out the words,
Then a bird whistled. My blood went cold. There were Imbrins inside. More that we hadn't known were here. Hostages. But if that was true, why weren't the whites trying to negotiate? My original plan had been to break down all the doors at once and charge inside, but if there were hostages, especially Imbrin hostages, I couldn't risk such rash action. I decided to have one of the hollows risk a look inside. All the windows were shuttered, though, which meant I'd have to send it through a door. I chose the smallest hollow, reeled out its dominant tongue. It licked the knob, gripped it. "I'm sending one inside," I said. "Just one, to look around." Slowly, the hollow turned the knob. On my silent count of three, the hollow pushed open the door. It leaned forward and pressed its black eye to the crack. "I'm looking inside." Through its eye I could see a slice of wall lined with cages, heavy black bird cages of various shapes and sizes. The hollow pressed the door open farther. I saw more cages, and now birds too, in the cages and out of them, chained to perches. But no whites.
"What do you see?" Emma said.
There wasn't time to explain, only to act. I made all my hollows throw open the doors at once, and they burst inside. There were birds everywhere, startled and squawking.
"Birds!" I said. "The room's full of Imbrins!"
"What?" Emma said.
"Where are the whites?"
"I don't know." The hollows were turning, smelling the air, searching every nook and cranny.
"That can't be," Miss Peregrine said. "All the kidnapped Imbrins are right here."
"Then what are these birds?" I said. Then, in a scratchy parrot voice, I heard one sing, "Run, rabbit, run! Run, rabbit, run!" And I realized these were not Imbrins. These were parrots. And they were ticking.
"Hit the dirt!"
I shouted, and we all dove to the ground behind the courtyard wall, the hollow pitching backward and taking me with it. I flung my hollows at the doors, but the parrot bombs went off before they could get through them, 10 at once, obliterating the building and the hollows in a terrible clap of thunder. As dirt and brick and bits of building flew through the courtyard and rained down on us, I felt the hollows' signals go dead together, all but one blacking from my mind. A cloud of smoke and feathers blew over the wall. The peculiars and Imbrins were streaked with dirt, coughing, checking one another for holes. I was in shock, or something like it, my eyes locked on a splattered patch of ground where a bit of pulped and quivering hologast had been flung. For an hour my mind had been stretching to accommodate 12 of them, and their sudden death had created a disorienting vacuum that left me feeling dizzy and strangely bereft. But crisis has a way of focusing the mind, and what happened next had my last remaining hollow in me sitting bolt upright. From beyond the wall came the sound of many voices shouting together, a great and rising battle cry, and beneath it a thunder of stampeding boots. Everyone froze and looked at me, dread furrowing their faces.
"What is that?" said Emma.
"Let me see," I said, and crawled away from my hollow to peer around the edge of the wall. A horde of whites was charging toward us across the smoking ground. 20 of them in a cluster, running with rifles and pistols raised, their white eyes and white teeth shining. They were unscathed by the explosion, having escaped, I assumed, into some underground